This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about what it's like to be Arab American or Muslim American in this post-9/11 period. And with me to discuss this topic is Mustafa Bayoumi. He's an associate professor of English at Brooklyn College, CUNY, and he's the co-editor of the Edward Said Reader. He's also a contributor to our sister organization, the Progressive Media Project. And he's the author of a brand new book that I highly recommend. It's called How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, Being Young and Arab in America? Mustafa Bayoumi, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Before we get to the book, here we are in the last moments of this presidential race. And still in all, there's this whispering campaign about Barack Obama being a Muslim or being an Arab. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a little bit crazy, and I think it illustrates a lot of the frightening tension in American society right now. The fact that being a Muslim or being an Arab is something so to be so afraid of is really it's just extraordinary to me. For example, the other day we had there was a rally with John McCain. And in these loud, boisterous rallies that have become like dangerous almost, you have a woman standing up and she's saying, "I don't trust Obama. I think he's an Arab." Already at that level, that's frightening to me. What's wrong with being an Arab? But then what really troubles me, though, is John McCain's answer to that. He stops and he shakes his head and he says, "No, ma'am, he's a decent family man." As if somehow being an Arab and being a decent family man are two mutually exclusive things.
And yet McCain was praised for doing that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it strikes me really, he was praised for doing that because it seemed like he was standing up for Obama. But by standing up for Obama, he's denigrating all Arab men in the United States and really in the world. And there's this way in which it's open season, basically, on Muslims and Arabs. We are very likely the most vulnerable political population in the United States today.
Do you think Barack Obama himself has done enough to say, "I'm not a Muslim, I'm not an Arab, but it would be okay if I were a Muslim and if I were an Arab"?
I don't think he has done enough. To my knowledge, he still hasn't visited a mosque. I think that's a big problem. In fact, I believe just the other day that Ralph Nader tried to do his own publicity around this question, going to visit the mosque in Washington, D.C., and saying it's time for McCain and Obama to visit a mosque. That illustrates, again, the political vulnerability. But I agree that Barack Obama needs to reach out and say that I'm a Christian, I'm not a Muslim, but there's really nothing wrong with being a Muslim. I call it the Seinfeld response. He could say, "I'm not a Muslim," not that there's anything wrong with that.
It is a real signature moment in American politics, though, that there can be this kind of, ethnic cleansing of our political field, that, you know, you can't be a Muslim American or an Arab American and being taken seriously as a candidate for president anyway. I mean, we do have a Muslim American or two in Congress now, finally, and The Progressive has an interview with Keith Ellison in our current issue, which is fun and nice to see. But, you've got this book out, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? And here we're talking about the very thing. That by identity alone, a huge group of people are considered a problem. Now, tell me about the title, because there's an interesting backstory to that.
Sure. Yeah, the title comes from the Souls of Black Folk, that classic work from W.E.B. Du Bois from 1903 when he published that. So it's a little more than 100 years old. And Du Bois's book really was an attempt to try to bridge the gap around the time of segregation. To show to the wider American society what African American life, what the African American experience is all about. And he, in fact, even uses the word veil in that book. He says, "I'm trying to pull back the veil on the experience in order to show to the rest of American society how we live. What's the rhythm of our lives? How do we follow our leaders? What's our religion? What's our experience? So it seemed to me that now is a good time to take that same question that Du Bois was talking about and raise it again more than 100 years later in the wake of September 11. Not to say, and I really want to mention this point too, not to say that there's any kind of equivalence between the African-American experience and the Arab-American experience. It's not that they're the same thing. Obviously, slavery and segregation, official discrimination, all of these things are much more profound and the injury is much deeper. And it's not meant in any way to piggyback on that experience, but rather to think about American difference.
But in a way, there are people in your book who say we are today's blacks or we are today's N-word.
That's right, yeah. And they do that, I think, for a couple of reasons. One is social exclusion. I mean, they're marginalized now, too, in a way that African-Americans are also marginalized. And we can think about that in particular around the idea of profiling. Profiling prior to September 11 was roundly condemned and was almost always associated with driving while black. Right, and it was a sense that if you're in a car and you're African American and the police want to pick on you or you're not in the right neighborhood, then they would stop you. And that was considered to be an illegitimate and unconstitutional use of force, use of law. Since September 11, profiling has entered the realm of necessary, rational, you know, national security kind of experiences. And that seems to me to be the wrong path to go down.
And it's now okay, Mustafa Bayoumi, according to the Bush administration's new guidelines for the FBI, to do a racial profiling. And you talk about some of the racial profiling and ethnic profiling in this book, TWA, Traveling While Arab. It's amazing how blanketed this policy is now. You know, I mentioned the FBI, and there's a part in your book, How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, at the beginning, where you talk about going to some Arab American communities in closed meetings, at least one, with the FBI. That struck me as an unusual circumstance and interesting one for a writer to have. Can you explain how you got in and what it was like?
Sure. Yeah, it was very interesting. When I decided that about the idea for this book, I knew that I had to get involved with the community leaders. And so I went and I involved myself. I introduced myself and talked to some of the community leaders, and I got along very well with them. And so one of them had told me that they were having a meeting with the FBI. And so I as a writer, I said, oh, well, can I come? So he said, of course, sure, why not? So he invited me along. And this was a closed-door meeting with the community leaders and the FBI, including Mark Marchand, who's the head of counterterrorism in the New York division. So he's, like, I think, the second in command of the FBI in New York or something like that. He's very high level, at any rate. So this was a very formal, you know, elaborate meeting that was held. And to me, it was interesting. It was kind of comical in a couple of ways. The two populations really, although the meeting was held in English, they just didn't see each other in the same way at all. I can give you one example. When I arrived at the meeting was held at the Muslim Youth Center in Bensonhurst. And so it was in this old Italian banquet hall that's now converted. So you have this big chandelier, mirrored walls, this riotous past, right? And we have these square tables that are set up, these tables that are set up in a big square. So the FBI are sitting on one end of the table, and we're sitting on the other ends. And then all the community leaders are talking to each other in Arabic, and they're saying, well, we should make the meeting a little bit better. Why don't we move some of the tables in the middle away so we can be closer and speak to them more familiarly? So all of this is happening in Arabic. Everybody says, yes, yes, yes. So they remove the tables, and we move closer to the FBI. They have no idea why, and they have this look of fear on their faces that they're being invaded by the Arab community.
The thing that came out of that encounter in the book that struck me, a couple things. One, the FBI was kind of being paternalistic and saying, we want you to appreciate the freedom-loving qualities of the United States of America. And the members of the community were saying, we got some real specific problems here, one of which is, you know, we're being profiled all the time and we're not allowed to get on airplanes. And I think one of them asked the FBI, what do we do about getting off the no-fly list? And they said, get to the airport early.
That's right. Yeah.
As if that would solve the problem.
Exactly.
And yeah. How did that meeting end?
The meeting ended basically with nowhere. Nowheresville, you could say. The community, everybody was very polite throughout the whole meeting. But you're right. The community leaders came and they said, we have specific grievances, and they wanted their grievances heard. And it was very interesting to me that the FBI came essentially to my ears. They came essentially to hear the community denounce terrorism. And what they said, I recall very clearly. They said, we are here to instill in you the freedoms of the United States. As if these people who are successful doctors and businessmen and lawyers, they're community leaders. They've been here for a generation. They've established themselves. They are already contributing very much to multicultural America, as if these people needed to be lectured on the values and the principles of the United States.
So, and they came for the freedoms anyway, many of them.
Exactly. It was really, to me, ultimately there were a few comic aspects, but it was tragic in the end that there was such a level of miscommunication coming from the FBI.
How big a problem has infiltration been? I mean, the FBI infiltrating groups, going undercover, sometimes for a couple years, and people wake up and, oh, this guy was a member of the FBI. I thought he was my friend.
Yeah, I think it is a significant problem. It's not a problem that happens in people's everyday lives, but it's a problem that happens enough that it causes a lot of suspicion within the community. My book concentrates on Brooklyn, but if you look at not only in Brooklyn, but across the country, at many of these terrorism prosecutions, you'll find that there's almost always the kind of dubious use of informants and undercover agents that underlie them. And these things are very corrosive to people's trust within the community. So there's a lot of suspicion that is actually to be found, especially when outsiders are coming into the community.
And I think our listeners also should know, this is Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, that if you're going to progressive events, anti-war events, peace events, other events of a political nature, chances are in this day and age, there's someone undercover.
Yeah, I think that that's probably very true.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't go. You should go, but you should know that the odds are good or bad, depending on how you're looking at it. My guest today is Mustafa Bayoumi. He's the author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem Being Young and Arab in America? What about the young part? Why did you focus on the young, or mostly in this book, I guess, between 18 and 25?
Yeah, the young people, to me, they really seemed like they were living a really complicated life, much more complicated than when I was a young person. For one thing, since they've really come of age in a post 9/11 era, we're now already 7 years after September 11. So they've really come of age at a time when they have to define their identity in a sometimes very hostile environment. And on the one hand, the community looks to them for the future. The community, many of them have immigrant parents, and the community sees their children as being more American. They can speak the language without an accent. They can identify American institutions easily. They say our future lies with you, the young people. So there's this kind of expectation on them. At the same time, though, it seems to me, especially for young men, that the culture is the most afraid of them. That and the young men, similar in some ways to young African American men, fear is attaching to them. And so I think the young people live in between these different kinds of expectations, somewhere between fear and the desire to make your world better.
Mustafa Bayoumi, you say there's an extra weight on these young people on top of all the weight that comes with being in that age group, and that actually being perceived as a problem is beleaguering in your terms. And have you felt that? I mean, you're not in that age cohort, but I'm wondering if you felt that beleaguering factor.
Almost every day, I'd have to say.
Is there one experience that stands out among others?
You know, it almost comes with the reading the newspaper in the morning. You know, there's a kind of daily onslaught of misinformation. With this campaign, I think clearly it's in the summertime, it was when Obama removed those two women who wear hijab from the Obama volunteers removed two women who wear hijab
in Dearborn, Michigan. Right?
Yes. And then there's a sense that you are disposable, you're expendable, you are the wretched of the earth, today's wretched of the earth. It's that kind of daily sense of being not appreciated for who you are, but being shuttled off into a group and then disposed of. And, you know, for me, it's just little things. Sometimes it's colleagues of mine sending me emails of things that asking me to explain to them what these things are, even though they come from clearly right-wing, xenophobic kind of websites. And my colleagues are honestly trying to understand the world, but then it just puts me in this box that I feel like that they should know better, and why should I be the one who has to explain these things to them? And
you're made to be a translator of the right. Wow, that's a task I wouldn't want to take on.
Yes.
In your introduction, you talk about a group of people that you don't include in this book, which interests me also, and that is Arab Americans or Muslim Americans who were so horrified by the climate after 9/11 that they assimilated to the nth degree, changing their names. And I wrote a book last year with the story of one such Arab American who was born with the name of Ahab Mohammed. He was an Egyptian American in Florida, very successful insurance man. Changed his name to Max Morgan in 2002. And still, he and six of his friends were kicked out of a Denny's. And the owner, manager of the Denny's says, "We don't serve bin Ladens here." So it didn't help Max Morgan any. How common is that, total changing of identity?
It is common, but I wouldn't say that it's the dominant force in the community. And particularly with the age cohort that I was talking to, it was something that happened a lot in high school within the first year or so after September 11, less so afterwards. They reflect on it sometimes jokingly. One of my friends told me not too long ago, he said, yes, he was also changing his name. He was saying that he was South American. He's a Yemeni. He's saying, "I'm South American," after September 11. And he said, but the Palestinians that he knew, they were even more specific. They said they're Venezuelan. So
I don't know if that'll help them these days, given yes. The climate against Hugo Chavez.
That's a good point.
Now, let's talk about some of the specific people you have in this book. I don't want to say profile, and you make a joke about that. You say these are portraits, not profiles. There's enough profiling going on. So you have portraits of six or seven people. And the first person's story, to my mind, I think was probably the most compelling of all. This is Rasha's story. Do you want to tell a little bit about it?
Yeah, sure. Rasha came, she was born in Syria, but she's now about 25 years old, and she's lived about 20 of those 25 years in the United States. So she's basically American raised, American bred, these sorts of things. But her family came and they filed an asylum claim when she arrived. And if you know anything about the immigration courts in this country, you know that such things as asylum claims can drag on for years and years and years. So they lived in a kind of legal limbo, somewhere in this intermediate gray zone of immigration status. That doesn't mean that they were illegal. It means that they were in this kind of gray zone. But it made them vulnerable, politically and legally vulnerable. About 6 months after September 11, Rasha was awoken one night, and she looked up and she sees some official in a police uniform waking her up, and she's wondering what's happened. And then she sees that her sister's also been woken up, and that she's told to get dressed and to go downstairs. Her whole family is being arrested. And she's wondering, why are we being arrested? And they're taken to detention. First, they're taken to downtown Manhattan, to a holding area there. And then eventually they're separated, the family separated, the men from the women. She has two younger brothers who are born in the United States, so they were not vulnerable. And so the younger brothers were left with a family friend, or actually a member of the family, extended family, while the rest of the family was put in detention. Initially, the family, there was a brief investigation around whether there was a terrorism cause for their detention. It seemed like it was quickly disposed of, that it was a fake reason for their detention. But eventually, they were put in prison for about 3 months. And Rasha is enormously affected by this experience. And she told me, "I thought that if I were to go to prison, it would be because I had done something wrong." And she hadn't done anything wrong. And for her, this was actually not an act of the legal justice system. It was an act of revenge for September 11.
Interestingly enough, in detention, they were not victims of other prisoners. That is, other prisoners who weren't Arab American or Muslim American did not gang up on them and retaliate for 9/11 or any of that crudeness that you could imagine. Rather, they got along quite well with the other women who were there. It was the guards who gave them trouble.
That's right, yeah. And they were put in a detention facility in a prison that housed both immigration detainees and criminal detainees. So they're all put in the same environment. And it was very interesting for Russia to see that power difference. So the guards themselves were horrific to her and her sister and her mother. And the whole administration and the structure, keeping her mother separated from talking to her son on the phone, for example, was a big incident for her mother. But they got along well with a lot of the other inmates. The other inmates helped everybody else keep sanity in a place that's really difficult to keep sane. And for Russia, it was a very instructive experience. And she learned from it the importance of not just human rights work, but also immigration law and searching for making this world a better place. She comes out of the experience strengthened by it. Rather than defeat it, she comes out saying, well, I have to change my world now for the better. And so there's actually a lot of hope at the end of her story.
There's also almost a Hollywood scene at the end of the story where you tell the story.
Yeah, it was incredible. She told it to me, and when she told it to me, her face just brightened up, and she was so excited by telling me about what happened. But shortly after her release, she and a bunch of her friends go to Chili's, I think it was, in Times Square, one of their favorite restaurants. And for Russia, she says it was incredible for her to be able to order food off of a menu. She felt free, like she hadn't been free for 3 months. At the Chili's, she actually sees one of the corrections officers who had given her mother a hard time. And so all of a sudden she feels empowered to go up to this man and basically tell him off. So she was able to actually confront her accuser, as I say in the end of the chapter, on this side of freedom.
Almost out of an Ariel Dorfman short story or movie, that was.
Yes.
I'm speaking with Mustafa Bayoumi, who's the author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? Being Young and Arab in America. Now, the roundup of Rasha and her family is just a snapshot of the 14,000 Muslims and Arabs in the United States who were rounded up in what I believe will go down in history as the Ashcroft Raids, just as we had the Palmer Raids in the late 19-teens and early 1920s. But this was even more, you point out in your book.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the Justice Department started providing numbers right after September 11, and they said 700 and something, and then 1,100 and something, and then they stopped providing numbers after that. And then the law professor, David Cole from Georgetown, he says that at a minimum there's 5,000 people who are arrested basically because of their birthplace. Essentially, they're arrested because of the place that they're born. Immigrants who are vulnerable arrested because of where they're born. And then added to that, you have the number of people who are arrested because of this program started a year after September 11 called special registration. And so that's another 14,000. So put together, you have at least 19,000, and it has to be actually a much larger number. Those are the reported numbers.
And of those, how many were terrorists?
Zero.
I mean, it is an incredible, incredible statistic. This is just a massive roundup, the likes of which we haven't seen since the roundup of Japanese Americans in World War II.
Yes, it's really a cleansing of the country. It was politically expedient at the time to look like you were cleansing the country from its Arab and Muslim threat.
Mustafa Bayoumi, tell the story of the Iraq war vet, because his is an interesting story as well.
Yeah, Sammy is he's an Arab American from Brooklyn, and his family's Christian. So it's also important to say that most Arab Americans in the United States, most Arab Americans, are Christian. About 75% are Christian.
And I think people don't understand that.
That's right, yes. There are, of course, Christian Arabs and Muslim Arabs, and there are, of course, non-Arab Muslims. And in the United States, maybe 25% of the Arab population is Muslim, and maybe 25% of the Muslim population is Arab. I hope you can follow that. But basically, Sammy's family comes from the Christian side of the Arab American family. And he was never very interested in his Arab identity. He had grown up around Puerto Rican and Latino kids, and that was really where he identified most profoundly.
Always had Latina girlfriends.
Exactly. His father is Palestinian and his mother is Egyptian, but his father came right after the Nakba, the catastrophe. So in the late 40s, he came to the United States. His mother came in the early 70s. And they met, and eventually they created a family. Now, Sammy was bored with his life, and so he decided that one of the things to do after having graduated high school, he was in college, he wasn't going anywhere. He said, "Well, maybe I'll join the service." He had been called by a recruiter one day. He said, "Yeah, that sounds like a good idea." This was March of 2001, and on September 10th of 2001, Sammy boards an overnight bus for his Marine combat training. And overnight, they, of course, on September 11, of course, there's the terrorist attacks. He discovers this on the bus, and immediately everything changes for everybody who's with him. Now, those who had signed up for the Marines know that they really will be going to war. So Sami eventually goes for two tours in Iraq, and something interesting happens there. He becomes more identified with his Arab side while he's in Iraq. He sees the landscape. He doesn't feel like he wants to harm the innocent people who are there, and he's a little bit afraid of the belligerence of some of the soldiers in his unit as well, the Marines in his unit. And so he actually develops a more of an Arab appreciation while he's in Iraq.
And he actually interceded at least one point to go to his commanding officer, as I recall the story, and ask the commanding officer to tell some of the other people in the unit to stop being sadistic.
That's right, to back off. They were screaming and yelling with bloodlust in their eyes. And Sami asks him, the commanding officer, if they can just ease off a little bit. And they say sure. And he says sure. Let them. And Sami feels good. Then he feels like he's been able to do something to diffuse the tension in the situation. So, but eventually he comes back from the war and he seeks out on his university campus, and he joins the Arab Association on his university campus. And many of the students there, the Arab students on his university, they don't want to have that much to do with him because they feel that he's fought in this war. And they are not supportive of this war, so they're not supportive of Sami. So Sammy's living somewhere in between all of his different experiences of who he is.
And that's a hard identity to try to walk, isn't it?
It sure is, yeah.
It was a very interesting story. We have a couple minutes left only. Mustafa Bayoumi, who's the author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem? I'm wondering if you think the climate is going to improve dramatically if Obama wins this election.
I think it's a coin toss. You know, it depends on which Obama we get in one way. I think that there's a very strong Obama that believes in civil rights and has a history of advocating for civil rights. And it seems to me that the Muslim question is really at the heart of the civil rights debate for the 21st century. And so I'm hoping that it'll be examined under that light instead of the national security light, which is a light of produced fear and concern. And it seems to me that actually we should look at it out of fairness and equality and justice. So if that's true, then I think that if Obama follows that track, then there could be some hope. But the biggest reason for my concern is the fact that the Arab American and the Muslim American experience is premised fundamentally not on what happens in the United States, but fundamentally on what American foreign policy is. So our situation in the United States will not improve until American foreign policy improves. So that also depends on which Obama we get.
Well, what hope do you have that he'll change the nature and functioning of the U.S. empire?
I have a lot less hope for that than I do for the fact that he'll come with a real civil rights agenda. I mean, this is an entrenched dogma in the United States that serves a lot of key interests. It seems to me that the future of the United States is really dependent on changing course, and changing course from being an empire alone in the world to being a nation among equals in the world, sharing, producing a just and equitable world for everybody. And that'll have direct real-world consequences for all kinds of people in the United States.
And part of that, of course, is getting over the Carter Doctrine that the Persian Gulf is, you know, basically our 51st state, and also, of course, finding a just solution to the prospects of a Palestinian state, which has been so far stymied for so many decades now. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Mustafa Bayoumi has been my guest. He's the author of How Does It Feel to Be a Problem, Being Young and Arab in America. Mustafa Bayoumi, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you again.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.